My name is Alicia, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Shannon will read the preamble.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Shannon, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Taylor will read the steps.
Thanks. Okay. Hi, my name is Taylor, and I'm an alcoholic. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Thanks.
Max will read the traditions.
I am Max. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants that do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be anonymous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Anita.
Hi, I'm Anita. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Atlantic Group. My sponsor's name is Faye. My sobriety date is September 15th, 2008, and I'm working steps 9 and 10. In a general way, we disclose what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm just going to get right in there. My first drunk was at 17. I was thinking on my way here, it's hard to believe now because I'm here, but I'd never been to a pub or a bar or bought a drink for myself until first day of college. And I remember that first day. I remember having that first drink. And I hear this in the rooms all the time, and it's true for me too, that sense of relief. You know, I had huge social anxiety. I'd been to an all-girls school, so I didn't really know how to talk to guys. And I just remember with that first drink, everything just came much easier. You know, I was in a group of people, I was laughing, I don't even remember how that night ended, but I do remember that by the end of that week, I had found a group of people who would drink like me. And I was drinking pint for pint with the guys, you know. And I didn't realize this till I came into the rooms of AA, but this is a progressive disease, which means it just gets worse. And by the end of that semester, I went back home for the holidays, and I remember it was New Year's Eve, and I went out with a bunch of people, and I passed out, blacked out outside the steps of this bar, and I was picked up by ambulance. Woke up New Year's Day. I was 18, in a hospital. And I remember it was awful. I had to ask my dad to come pick me up on New Year's Day. And for some people, they just realized that, drinking didn't really work for them, or they didn't, they couldn't drink. But for me, I just went straight back to college and I kept drinking. I was a daily drinker all through college. Barely graduated, which was a real blow for me because I was an academic kid. And I started working. And again, I found a job, and I found the people at that job who would drink like me. I made career choices that made drinking easier. And, I do remember, my friends, from college, they were starting to get married. They were starting to have children. They were buying their first homes. And I was just, still out every night drinking. And, I remember, I had such low self-esteem, but at the same time, it was so weird to me. I had enormous sense of self-importance. And I thought that, England was too small for me. I thought I was going to get my career really kick-started and I was going to go to America. And it's such a weird, feeling. I couldn't describe it to anyone else but a room full of alcoholics. No, I don't think anyone else would understand that sort of incongruity. But anyway, I get to America and carry on drinking, but now I haven't got my my friends or my family with me. And I only realized this when I came into the rooms of AA, that was sort of what was known as doing a geographical, cure. But the disease came with me. I thought I was going to start fresh, but the disease came with me. And it got darker. It got really dark because I was drinking alone in bars. I just fell off enough bar stools and I went home with, the wrong people enough times to sort of realize that it was safer for me to just drink at home, alone. So I, you know, would finish work, buy a bottle of wine, go home, drink alone. And then one bottle became two bottles. And, you know, it was just miserable. I did this every day for a long time. And I could just see all of my friends, you know, moving on with their lives. And my life just stood still. And towards the end, you know, even alcohol wasn't enough for me, and I turned to other substances. And the decline was so rapid, it scared me, it terrified me. And I just remember, you know, there were a series of kind of events that kind of led me, ushered me into the rooms. And I just remember one of them was just waking up, you know, and this wasn't the first time. I was starting to call in sick a lot more for work. And that was one thing that had kept me in denial for a long time about being an alcoholic, because I was able to get up and show up and go to work and function, you know, of a sort. But I was able to get there, and now I wasn't even able to get into work, and I was calling in sick midweek, you know, repeatedly, week after week. And I remember it was a Wednesday afternoon, I woke up, there was shattered glass on the floor, got blood on my toes, on my feet. And the blinds were drawn, they had been for a couple of days, and I just hadn't been out my apartment, and I didn't know who to call. I couldn't call my family in England, I didn't have any friends, and I just knew that the party was over. And I called my my therapist, and I just said, I don't know what to do. She said, go to a meeting. And I did. Not immediately, but I did. And then I just remember just sitting at the back and my hair down, and I just remember crying a lot because I identified. And I didn't know what to do. I had no idea. I just sat there and I understood and related to the stories, and I just kept coming back, but I kept going out. And I didn't really understand what people meant when they said they had resentments or write it out or did a fifth step or what. I just didn't get it, you know, the lingo. But someone told me to come to this group, this meeting, and I came and I had about 3 or 4 days. And I happened to just sit next to a sober woman, Sharon, who introduced me to her sponsor. And I asked her sponsor, Faye, to be my sponsor. And things just started to get better immediately. We started reading the big book together. It started to make sense to me, you know. The writing isn't the easiest, you know. You know what I mean? but we started working the steps, and the relief came immediately, you know. I wrote out my story,
when I came into AA, I wasn't prepared. I just wanted to stop drinking. I just wanted to, you know, live life. I didn't know that, you know, there was all this other stuff that came with it. I didn't know how gut-wrenching it would be or how emotional the whole process would be. And it really does, you know, I just thought it was just about not, you know, getting sober. But what happened for me was the emotions that I've been trying to suppress for years and years and years, they came up. And, you know, through the process of working the steps with my sponsor, I was able to deal with those emotions and process them in a way that I never thought I could. And so if you're a newcomer, or if you're counting days, or if you're coming back, get a sponsor. You know, I found the happiest person I know to be my sponsor, because I wanted what she had. I didn't want to get sober and be miserable. She's so happy, and she just shows me how to have a relationship with myself and with other people, just how to be a part of and how to communicate, how to be open. She says to me that she's going to drag me kicking and screaming to being joyous, happy, and free. And I'm telling you, in spite of myself, this program is working. Thank you very, very much.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Craig.
Thank you. My name's Craig. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is February 10th, 1990. I don't have a home group. I have too many groups to name, actually. I'm working on all the steps, and my sponsor's Jim Johnson in Florida. And I'm kind of on edge tonight because I have my best friend in the program down in Florida with his wife, who's also in the program, and she's in labor right now. So I turned my phone off. I told him, sorry, you know, I have to speak. It's a little more important right now, but we're waiting on a baby. But I was 23 when I got sober, so you can do the math. But I started fast out of the gates. I was 11 years old when I started using, and it was great. I had my first drink when I was 14, so I started off with dry goods, but I ended up a classic alcoholic in the end. Whenever I used, I was always drunk, always hammered. I never had one drink. The only time I had one drink was in high school, my senior year, the senior skip day or whatever they call that, and we went to 7-Eleven, and we got these 40-ounce cups, and we filled them with Everclear and some kind of punch, and that was the only time I had one drink. That did the job for me. So I don't have a lot of time tonight, so I'll just give you a few of my highlights, or lowlights, you know, if you want to call them. I remember when I was 18, I was going to go to this rush party for college, and it was all the cool people. I wanted to be a part of this fraternity, and I stepped out. I must have looked right out of a John Cusack 1980s movie. You know, I was a rock star. I had the asymmetrical shirt on. I'm not going to admit, I don't think I had parachute pants, but it looked something similar to that. And I was going to go to this party, and I was going to show these people how to party Animal House style. And I don't know why, but I brought a bottle of vodka, and I just hit straight from the bottle of vodka. And little did I know that if you drink that fast enough, your legs give out. And so I was drinking, talking to this girl, and my legs gave out, and I fell to the ground, and I was like, oh. So next thing I know, I back up and I sit on a glass table that's smashed. And I don't know how this works, but every time that happens, the music stops and people just turn around and they all look and it gets real quiet in the room. I don't get that, but it happened to me. And they had to carry me out of there. And my friends told me that we went to another party that night that I don't remember. But I remember walking out saying, I'll pay for it, I'll pay for it. But I have to tell you, that was one of the greatest social embarrassments in my life, because these were the people that I wanted to be around, and I made an absolute fool out of myself, and it kept me sick for a long time. I was always looking over my shoulder. I always wanted to just be liked, and I was really somewhat of a likable guy. I was a happy drunk, but I became reckless as my disease progressed, and when I was 18, the seed was planted for me, and I had spent a night in jail with the possession of controlled substance. There was another possession of controlled substance that summer, and it was a possession of alcohol, too. So it was a good summer in my household. And that's when the seed was planted. My parents said, do you think you have a problem? And I said, yes, I think I do, just to get out of trouble. And they sent me to a drug counselor, and he sent me to AA, and that's where the seed was planted, and it grew from there. And my relapse was worse than any drunk that I'd ever had, and I'd only been sober for 2 months, and that night I drank two bottles of scotch with two other guys, and I remember driving this car home, this guy's car. He's in the back throwing up, and I'm driving. It's two lanes, one going this way and one going this way, but I'm seeing three lanes, and I'm in the middle lane. I got one eye open and one eye closed. It's like 4 a.m. So I'm lucky I'm not one of those stories where I killed some people, because I've heard those stories over and over again in AA. I'm so lucky, because I was an experienced drunk driver. I did a lot of it. So and back in that day, I got pulled over for DUIs, and they didn't give them to me. I couldn't say my ABCs one night, and they still let me go. They just let my friend drive. So I dodged a lot of bullets, but I relapsed. I went away to college, and I got sick. And I needed that 4 years because I didn't have a good enough fourth step yet. And I created some good stuff for that fourth step over the next 3 to 4 years. And I finally came to the rooms. And the funny thing was, when I was ready to get sober, this was February 9th, 1990, I was at a bar with a friend. I drove home that night drunk. I wrecked my car somewhere along the road, but I still got it into the driveway because when I made a decision to get home, I was going to get there no matter what. I got there, I put the car in the driveway, and I went to bed. And I woke up in the morning, and my mom had this look of horror on her face. You know, what happened to your car? And I have no idea. And I went outside and I looked. It was just sitting there. Both front tires were blown out. The air dam was smashed. And it was a wreck. And you could see kind of where I drove on rims all the way down the road, my neighborhood, all the way down the driveway into the front. So you could see the trail. And it scared me enough that was the last day I had a drink, or the night before. And I don't know if I was touched by the hand of God that moment. I don't know. But all I can tell you is since that day, I've not had an obsession to drink. And it's been 19 years. Except for once. I was at a place in Palm Beach with my boss, and somebody sent us a bottle of Chateau Margaux 1974. And I didn't tell them that I didn't drink, but they decantered it in front of me. And it seemed like there was a spotlight on it, and there was angels' voices in the background. Just thinking, this looks good, you know, but I couldn't touch it. But it's a small sacrifice. But I had met this guy in the bars who was in the program 10 years, and he told me where to go. I went to a meeting, and I met these guys. I went to a Wednesday night men's meeting in St. Louis where I grew up, and I met these guys, and here these guys are sitting around talking honestly about themselves without shaming and ridiculing themselves. Very hard for me to open up about myself. I could tell you a lot of things about you, but I didn't want to say anything about me. The first 4 months was very tough. But I ended up hearing this guy, Chip, say, well, get on your knees and just fake it till you make it. And I could do that. You know, I wasn't real. So I was like, I could do that. So I went at home. I locked myself in my room, make sure nobody caught me. And I got on my knees and I prayed that night. And that was 4 months into sobriety, and I have not missed a day of prayer since. Over 19 years, not once. I traveled over to Thailand once, and it was international time zone thing, and maybe I was, but I got down on the plane in the bathroom and prayed on my knees. And I put, you know, napkins down, but I did it. And I've not gone longer than 9 days without a meeting in 19 years, and those 9 days were because I was in a remote island that didn't have an AA meeting. There was plenty of drunks there, but they didn't have an AA meeting. And I tried to get online, but could not. But I proved beyond the shadow of a doubt that I was powerless over alcohol, because I always said I'd go out and have one drink, and I always couldn't stop. As soon as I put that one drink in my system, I lost the power to choose. I had to drink. I convinced myself over and over and over again. So here I was, I admitted that I was powerless, and my life was unmanageable. All my credit card debt was liquid debt. It was all bar tabs. You know, I was living at home. Thank God my parents were codependent. And and I still had a job. I guess you're considered a high-functioning alcoholic if you still have a job. I still had a job. And then I was faced with this God thing, but I got on my knees and I started saying some words, and I feel like it talks about in the big book, in the spiritual appendix, there's some that get hit right away and some of the educational variety, and I'm of the educational variety. It took me a while to develop my belief system, but I did it through persistence. It's almost like if you clasp your hands and your left thumb is over your right thumb and that's comfortable. If you go and do it the opposite, it's uncomfortable, but if you do this long enough, it becomes comfortable. So just through persistence, I got comfortable with prayer, and things started to take off for me. And I've had a lot of out-in-the-world stretches in my 19 years. I've moved around. They weren't geographical escapes. They were honest moves for career. I'm here in New York for a career move. I've got great friends in Palm Beach, in St. Louis, in New York, in Washington, D.C., where I've lived, all in the program. I've got a lot of great friends that are here in this room tonight. I sponsor people. I go to meetings on a regular basis, 3 to 4 meetings a week. I pray every day. I do everything that I was told to do. I built a foundation. I didn't have a relationship with a girl for 14 months when I first came in here. And the irony behind that is that when I did sleep with somebody, she was drunk. She took advantage of me. I was home vulnerable on a Saturday night, and she called me to pick her up, and I did, and whatever. So, anyway, I appreciate the opportunity to lead tonight, and thank you very much.
And our main speaker tonight is Anne Marie.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name's Anne Marie. I'm an alcoholic. And it's wonderful to be here tonight. I actually have heard so many things about the Atlanta Group, and you all have a very good reputation across the river in New Jersey, which is where I come from. And even though it is only 12 miles west of here, it still takes an hour and a half to get here, which is precisely what happened to me tonight. But it's really nice to be here, and I've actually never seen so many faces before at a meeting. Can I push this down more? Is that all right? Can I do that? Thanks. Perfect. Thank you. I've never seen so many people before, actually, at one meeting. My last speaking commitment, which was only 3 weeks ago, had 4 people there. And this is a little different. It's actually really funny, because when I walked into my, it was at my home group in Secaucus, and I walked in, and I was like, where is everybody? And one of the newcomers was like, I texted everyone to let them know you were coming. And I was like, is that why no one's here? Like, where is, do I share too much? Is this the issue? But I found out it was actually the very first night of, like, sober coffee house in Hoboken, so that got precedent. But anyway, it's nice to be here. My home group is in Secaucus, New Jersey. I also go to the Bernardsville Spiritual Awakenings group. That's actually where I found the big book and I found the steps, which is precisely how I ended up here tonight from my friend Chris. I have been sober since 1997, although, as I was telling Heidi, my home group does not celebrate time, so I no longer celebrate my anniversary. I tend to celebrate my sobriety every day rather than yearly. And the reason that I tend to do that is because what happened to me in sobriety was that my ego rebuilt itself. And I got to a point where I was embarrassed to come to an AA meeting to say I wanted to drink because I felt like I was doing something wrong. I felt like I wasn't good enough. I felt all the old feelings that alcohol did to me, all of a sudden time in AA did to me. And I'm not, I don't blame time in AA. I blame my own alcoholic ego for this. But I say that because it's amazing how my ego can latch on to anything. My ego can latch on to things that will destroy, like, my ego will destroy me whether it latches on to things that are technically bad for me or technically good for me. So it really has nothing to do with the substance. It has to do with my own disease, which is both spiritual, mental, and physical. But the obsession is insidious. Absolutely is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and it still gets me sometimes, you know. I'll get into that. Basically, I started drinking when I was 12 when I started drinking on a regular basis. You know, I say that I tried drinking when I was 9. It was something that I did when I came home and DuckTales was on. There was Budweiser in the refrigerator. My babysitter wasn't paying attention, so I grabbed a six-pack and went in and watched Huey, Dewey, and Louie. And I had a really good time, and it was fine, and it was fun, and it was better than chunky soup, which is what I usually had after school. And I remember thinking, like, why is this so bad? Why does mom give my dad such a hard time about this? This is not that bad. Like, what's the problem? Needless to say, I 3 years later started to find out what the problem was, because I can honestly tell you that I do not remember a time where I had just one drink. From the get-go, I drank alcoholically. From the get-go, I didn't understand the point in wasting the calories of a beer if I wasn't going to get drunk. From the get-go, it just didn't make sense. Unless I'm going to get absolutely wasted, why even bother? It's not like it's social, you know? But I will say, I never knew when that point was going to come, and I so badly wanted to stop that point here, when really I always ended up here. You know, I always went full steam ahead, and I wished I could have pulled it back to like half the throttle, because that was the goal. That was where I wanted to be, was right in the middle, where I felt really good that I didn't need to be myself and I could be anybody that you wanted me to be, so then maybe you would like me. But the problem was that I always went to the nth degree, where I then became who the demon inside of me likes to be. I became physically abusive, I became verbally abusive, I blacked out, I passed out. I mean, I really did it all. And the sad thing is that I never had a legal drink. By the time I was, 12, 13, 14, I knew what AA was because my father had gone to AA when I was a child. And I remember he made 90 days, and then a few months later, we'd have another party for 90 days. And then a few months later, we'd have another party for 90 days. And this is how it went. And eventually, he ended up moving to Florida. And we stayed in New Jersey. And he got really angry and said that AA makes you get divorced and move to Florida. And that was AA's fault. So I'm not sure if it was AA or an Al-Anon, but, somehow they got divorced, which was actually the greatest gift in the world. I actually said to my mother, when she said, "Your father and I are getting divorced," I said, "Thank you." Now, that should tell you something about alcoholism. A 12-year-old is thanking her mother for getting divorced. That's how devastating this disease is. That's how long its tentacles are, because my father traveled a lot. He was never really around all that much, and when he was around, he was drunk, and so I wasn't really around him. But I still knew the devastating effects. There was still constant eggs in my household growing up. Like, you couldn't go any... Like, nothing was fun. Nothing was fun. There was no joy in life. It was, you were nervous, you were anxious, you were upset, you were waiting. There was no, right here, right now, have a good time, let's throw a ball in the yard. No such thing. And the reason that was absent was because of alcoholism. And that is what I became. And I actually found myself at the end of my drinking, looking in the mirror going, how did I become my father? How did this happen? And let me back up to when I was like 12, 13, I started to drink, and I would drink on the weekends, and I was, I always looked older than I was. By the time I was 14, I could buy alcohol because they didn't really check fake IDs very well back then. But I always looked older than I was. And so I would have someone drive me to the liquor store, and I'd go in, and I'd flirt with the guy behind the counter, and I would get my alcohol, and I'd put it in the car, and I'd go home, and the next day I would do the same thing. So right from an early age, I learned very quickly how to use sex appeal also to get exactly what I wanted, which is another form of way my disease comes out. And it's the manipulation is unbelievable of what I am capable of. And so this is what I would do to get alcohol, and I would drink. I could be at a party. I could be at a movie. I could be at someone's house. I could be home alone. I would drink. That was Friday and Saturday night. That's what I wanted to do. And if you didn't want to do it, then I didn't really want to hang out with you. And this proceeded to go on for about, 3 or 4 years, where it was weekend drinking, and it was every weekend drinking. And I was 12, 13, 14, 15, and I was hanging out with 17, 18, 19-year-olds. And that also was deliberate because they could get me to the liquor store to buy alcohol. And what happened was when I was about 14 was that I ended up losing a lot of weight. And I ended up being hospitalized for anorexia. Now, I went to the hospital for about 4 months. And it was a locked down, you can't get out, you can't get in psych ward, right? And I am blaming my mother. Mind you, I am like 80 pounds. I'm totally blaming my mother for putting me here. Like, what is your problem? I just want to be thin. Like, you don't understand. But what I didn't know at that time was that was really just another form of untreated alcoholism for me. And I didn't know that. And nobody could have told me that at the time. In fact, actually, I came home from the hospital. I relapsed, lost like 20 pounds in 4 months, went back to the hospital. And they sent me to an AA meeting when I was there. And I remember being really insulted that I was at this AA meeting, because when they came around, they asked everybody to introduce themselves. I said, "My name's Anne-Marie, and I'm here because my father's an alcoholic." And everybody just started laughing. And I was like, "Why is this funny?" And I really didn't understand it, but I will tell you that the way I ended up in the hospital was because I drank so much the weekend before that I ended up in almost alcoholic coma. My BAC level was a 375, and I was like 90 pounds. I was rushed to the hospital. I caused this huge drama, huge scene at this like private school dance I was at. And this is what Anne-Marie did. Like, this was not the first time Anne-Marie got rushed to the hospital with alcohol poisoning. This was not the first time that Anne-Marie thought it was a good idea to drink without having eaten for 2 days. And the whole thing was that my entire existence was based upon what I could get from you to serve my needs. But the insidiousness about that was that I didn't know that. I didn't think that. I was not conscious of that. What I thought I was doing was I thought I was giving of myself oh so much to get you to like me because that would validate my self-esteem. I had no idea I thought so well of myself. I really didn't. I had no idea I was an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. I truly thought I just had the inferiority complex. Then I got sober and realized how much of an ego I had. But once I got out of the hospital, when I was there, the only thing I wanted to do was get out and drink. That was the only thing I missed. I am locked up in a psychiatric ward. I mean, come on, how many people in their teens end up in a psychiatric ward locked in there, like, during Christmas, and it doesn't faze them? The only thing that bothers them is that they can't go out and drink this weekend. That's the only thing that really bothered me. And never really dawned on me that I shouldn't be there, because I actually felt somewhat comfortable there. I have to say, I definitely feel like I didn't belong there, let's put it that way. And there was like a white room. I mean, this place was a certified loony bin. And there I was, and it was, you know, I felt normal for the first time. And that should have been my first clue, that I felt normal in the loony bin, but it didn't. So what happened was that after I got out of there, I ended up going to boarding school, because they said you're not allowed to go home. So I ended up going to boarding school, which was fantastic for my alcoholism. And what happened and what started to happen at boarding school was, as I look back, it became very clear that I started to live the double life. Then I started to live the quadruple life. Then I started to live however many more lives you can possibly take on. And I only had 80 girls in my class. And that was the other thing. My mother was like, oh, you're going to an all-girl boarding school. Hee-hee. Like, all-girl boarding school. I was a full-blown alcoholic. Are you kidding me? And I got dropped off in the middle of nowhere in upstate New York. But I managed to find alcohol. So I get there. And my first weekend, I walk down the street so I can stand in the dumpster area of Subway to smoke a couple cigarettes with my newfound friend. And then the next week, I did the same thing. And then the next week, I managed to find vodka to accompany the cigarette. And then they started to catch on to this, so they wouldn't let me go to Subway anymore. So I became a runner. I started running races. The whole point of my running career was so I could run far enough off campus so I could smoke my cigarettes, drink my alcohol, and run back. That was the whole reason why I weren't running. And nobody could ever figure out why I wasn't losing weight. Because I used to go out there and I would eat God only knows what because I was drinking and I was so drunk and it became a game to get home on my own 2 feet. And because the faster I ran, the more I'd sober up, so I thought. And at the same time, I'm running the school. I am the vice president of student council. I'm in charge of like their mentorship program, which is really frightening for these girls. And I'm in charge of their mentorship program. I'm vice president of student council. I am the number one person to get alcohol because I'm the only one with a fake ID. And I have a boyfriend. And that boyfriend doesn't know about the other boyfriend. And I literally, like, everything was all lined up. And that was what I did. And as the end of boarding school started to come, alcoholism started to crash in. Because the thing about alcoholism is that I hated being who I was, and the fact of the matter is I really didn't know who I was. I had no idea, because I was too scared to really find out, because I was afraid that's how horrible she truly was. And so I just became who you wanted me to be. That seemed a lot easier. It seemed like a lot less work to just be who you wanted me to be than to actually sit down and try and figure out what I liked and who I was. I mean, you literally can look at my past according to whoever I was dating. If I was dating like a hiker, crunchy, organic guy, I loved hiking. Like, you know, woods were the greatest places in the world to be. And, you know, I stopped dating him and I went for a hike. I was like, this is awful.
Who likes to walk around for hours at a time when you don't know where you're going? This is not fun. You know, and then the next time I dated somebody who really liked rap and was all into rap stars and blah, blah, blah. I was all into rap stars. I got out of the relationship. I was like, I don't like rap. I like you too. Why'd I don't like rap. You know, and I never took the time to get to know myself. I just became who you wanted me to be. That was my role. And at the end of boarding school, my life started to crash in. It became too difficult to keep the lives separate. 2 months before graduation, it was the blizzard of 96. Blizzard of 96, and like all of Albany shut down. But Anne-Marie's outside with her backpack on, trucking through 3.5 feet of snow when only emergency vehicles are allowed on the street. And I am trucking down to the liquor store. And I get down there and I fill up the backpack and I truck back. And I drank and drank and drank and drank. And I ended up in a blackout where I tried to break into a house parent's home. I managed to succeed at it. And I fell asleep on her couch. And she woke me up, brought me to the health center. And the next morning, the dean of students is standing there ready to expel me. And the health nurse, the school nurse, lied for me. She said she was sleepwalking. And I was really glad that she did. But that didn't stop me. I did the same exact thing the next week, and I didn't break into the woman's house. But, I mean, I went out and I drank. And there I was, like, almost not ready to graduate from high school. It didn't matter. I had been in high school at, like, 5 years at this point. The big joke in my family was, like, let's see if Anne-Marie can make it out of high school, you know? Like, everybody in my family has, like, you know, master's degrees, doctorates, and here I am trying desperately to get out of high school. And I managed to do it simply not by my own merit, but because the health nurse lied for me. So, in the last month of school, they actually started to really wise up to me. They searched my room. They just, you know, I wasn't allowed off campus. It was all my walls started crashing in. And what I found was that trying to keep my persona straight, I couldn't do it anymore. Things were just starting to crash in all around me. And after high school, I ended up moving down to D.C. for a few months. And I did the same exact thing in D.C. that I did in Albany, except my life in D.C., setting up like six of them, crashed in a matter of like 6 weeks. I was no longer capable of controlling anything. I mean, from the get-go, when I put alcohol in my body, I definitely ignited a physical craving where I had no choice but to drink more. I definitely ignited my liver where I could not not drink once I started. But the thing was that definitely by the time I got to D.C., I also had no choice whether or not I drank, whether or not I had alcohol in my body to start with. It was an automatic mental obsession. I was drinking to satisfy an obsession beyond my mental control. That's the only way I can put it. And I did the same thing in D.C., and then from D.C. I moved to New Orleans, because that's where all good alcoholics go for college. And when I ended up in New Orleans, I picked my college based solely on where you could drink at the age of 18. And I got down there, and my very first night out, I was escorted home by the police. And I was escorted home by the police because I had drank so much, I had blacked out, that I was trying to break into a dorm in a different college, not even on my own college campus. It wasn't my dorm, it wasn't even my own college. Like, I was completely off the map. And I had no idea about this. None. And my drinking actually got worse after that. I can't even tell you the amount of dangerous situations I put myself in, the amount of violent situations I put myself in. The things that I did, the things that happened to me were outstanding and nobody should ever have to live through them. However, it was all necessary for me to get here. Because you see, there was things where I was like, oh, I'm different. I'm just a little different. You know, like that doesn't happen. I don't drink every day. At that point, I just didn't drink on like Wednesdays. You know, I drank other 6 days, but since I didn't drink every day, I wasn't an alcoholic. Well, then when I started drinking on Wednesdays, I was like, I still only drink after 6 o'clock at night, you know? Then it became 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And next thing you know, it is at the end of the year, my friends, dropped me off at an AA meeting because they're saying, I have a drinking problem. I am surrounded by 18-year-olds in New Orleans who think I have a drinking problem. That's how bad I stood out. And they dropped me off while they went to go get high, and I'm sitting at this AA meeting, and They're saying, you know, is anyone new? And God bless you guys for standing up, because I don't know if I would have had the courage to do that. I sat there and I raised my hand and I said, my name's Anne-Marie and I'm a... And I just started sobbing. And I just started crying and crying and crying. And the thing was that I didn't know why I was crying. I thought I was crying because I thought I was embarrassed. I started crying because it was the first time I actually told the truth in my entire life. I am so outrageously, naturally dishonest because of this disease. It's incredible. And any time I tell the truth, I truly have a spiritual experience. Because nobody expects it, least of all me. You know? I mean, we were driving here, my friend's like, this is my first time at an AA meeting in New York. And I was like, yeah, me too. No, that's not true. No. I was like, well, the first time. No, I can't even say that, can I? And, you know, that's not true. I worked here for a few months, and I went to meetings all the time. But for some reason, I'm like, yeah, me too. And that's what I do. So I started crying hysterically. That weekend, my mother came down to visit me. She asked me, you know, how are the finals going? Fast forward, and long story short, she ends up putting me in her hotel room with her. And I rented a laptop so I would actually do my work. And she goes to sleep. And I went downstairs, honest to God, just to have a cigarette. This is the one and only time I can say I wasn't going to drink. I wasn't choosing to drink. It wasn't like, oh, I just want to go get messed up. You know, all those lies I would tell myself that this was my choice. No, I went downstairs to have a cigarette. I came back at 6 o'clock in the morning, drunk out of my mind, in cars with people I don't even know who they are. Last thing I remember was telling somebody my name was Mary and I was from Tennessee. That's the last thing I remember telling anybody. And I was just drunk out of my mind. And my mother wakes me up an hour later, and she's like, did you get a lot of work done? And I just started crying, and I said, I can't do this anymore. I have a drinking problem. So we talk a lot about it, and we talk about my dad, and we talk about, like, you know, things, what it's about. And she said, well, you're enrolled for summer school. Come home. We'll deal with it then. Well, that window of willingness shut real fast. By the time I got home, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have a problem. Give me your car keys. I got to go. And I ended up driving out one night, and I picked up my friends, and we went to the movies. And here's the deal. And it took me a long time in sobriety to get really honest about this. I was driving home from the movies with a girl in my car, and we ended up getting in a really bad car accident where I flipped the car 3.5 times, took out a telephone pole, took out a fence. I didn't have my seatbelt on. The sunroof was open, windows were open. And I ended up in the back seat. Both of us walked away with it without a scratch. She had no idea I was drinking, because I was drinking out of a water bottle. And I was pretending like it was water, and it was straight vodka. And I could not even go to the movies without drinking. And I couldn't even tell her I had been drinking. To me, I was like, I just wanted a CD from the back seat, you know, and that's why I got in the car accident. And when I crawled across the gravel and the glass to get out of the car, I turn and I look at her, and she has a bloody nose, and I didn't even care if she was okay. It genuinely did not even cross my mind until, like, the fifth thought. The first one was, oh, my God, I'm in so much trouble. Second one was, oh, God, I hope the cops don't come, you know, and it went all the way down the list, and then I was like, oh, are you all right? Didn't even dawn on me, and I was really ashamed to mention that in AA for a very long time, but you know what? That's the reality of our disease. And I proceeded to then drink every day, morning, noon, and night for the next 3 months. And I was in such a situation where my family didn't want to talk to me. They didn't talk to me. They just treated me like I was a statue in their home. They would reach over me. They would talk over me. I didn't have any friends. I started hallucinating on alcohol. I would be on the phone with this total hostage that I took. I don't know why he was still with me. And I would be talking to him, and then all of a sudden I would start telling him I was somebody different because I just finished reading this book, and I would take this persona on, and he's like, what are you talking about? And I remember snapping in and snapping out. I would snap into the story, I would snap into my life, and then I'd snap back out. And then I'd snap back in, and I'm like, where'd the last half hour, where'd the last 3 days go? And I would snap in and out, and I remember how scary that snapping was and how much I tried to make it normal. You know, I was like, he was like, what are you talking about? And that's when I snapped in, and I was like, what am I talking about? You know, I don't know. And I would just ask him a couple questions to try and get the idea of what I was saying, and then I just kept going with it because my pride was so great. God forbid I say I'm sorry. God forbid I say, you know, I'm lying. And And I ended up, because of the car accident, I ended up having to go to court, and the judge told me that basically I would have no punishment if I could just get one clean drug test. Now, we all know it takes 24 hours for alcohol to go through your system. I couldn't get one clean drug test in 3 months. I tried. Every day I woke up and I tried. I knew I was going to lose my license. I knew I was going to jail. And I got there and I could not get it. And I got to court and he said, "Do you want to go to rehab or do you want to go to jail?" And I didn't answer him because I'm sitting there thinking, well, at least in jail, I can probably still get messed up. Don't do drugs, but I'm open. I'm open to possibilities. I don't mind, you know. Well, you know, what's 30 days? What's 60 days? And that was pretty much how I felt about it. But God came in and said, rehab. And I ended up going to rehab. And to make a long story short, what happened was that when I got here, I just put one foot in front of the other. I followed everybody around. They said, "We're going to eat now." I sat down and ate. They said, "You're going to go to a meeting now." I went to the meeting. They said, "You're going to call me now." And actually, I was not very good at calling. But, you know, I showed up other ways. And at a year and a half sober, I wanted to kill myself. And I had not felt that way since I had been drinking. And I tried to kill myself twice when I was drinking. And it was spurred by the fact that my higher power finally broke up with me and moved back to Texas. And I strongly advise, especially women, not to date until you do the steps, because he does become the higher power. And he definitely became the higher power, and I didn't know he was the higher power until he was in Texas. And then I was like, uh-oh, I don't have one. And I never cried at the breakup. When I cried was when my friend said to me, "You know what you have to do?" And I said, "No." She goes, "You have to pray." And that's when the tears came, because I looked at her and I said, "I don't know how to do that." And I was embarrassed because I had been in AA for a year and a half. I am an alcoholic here to save my life. Why would I walk into an AA meeting embarrassed to say anything? This is a safe and open environment where we are to be as honest as we possibly can, because that is the only way we are going to stay alive. The only way I'm going to stay alive is when the truth comes out, God can come in. That is why I have a spiritual experience every time I tell the truth. Not because I'm some great person who can tell the truth. God, I would love that if that were the case. But I'm not. What happens is the truth comes out and God comes in. And that's the only way I know how to do it. And she took me to this meeting in Burnersville, which had just started. And I walk in and they're talking about the big book. And I was like, oh God, I hate these people. But I sat down anyway. And my life was changed forever. And I ended up working with this woman and we went through the steps and you know, I went through the first step and the second step and I took the third step and I went through everything. I made my amends. Everything was great. And then I got to a point where my ego had rebuilt itself and I didn't even know it. And there I am, 6 years sober, standing in London, because I had moved to London at that point, standing in London wanting to throw myself in front of a bus again. And again, the grace of God just came in and brought me over to the phone box. And I called this woman I had asked to be my sponsor. And when I had asked her to be my sponsor, I didn't even know why I was asking her to be my sponsor. I mean, talk about people who normally won't mix. This woman had like pink and black and gray dreadlocks and wore like a really short skirt. And I'm like, here I am, this like preppy, lawyerly-like person. And I'm talking to her and I'm telling her all these things that have happened in my life. And I was like, oh, I just got married. I just graduated from college. I just got my dream job. I just moved from London, or I just moved to London. Now my stepfather died. And there's all these things outside of me that were taking place. And I said, and I'm just at this place where I have so much on top of me and I just want to die. And she looked at me. She goes, do you think you're going to drink today? I was flat out insulted. She asked me that question. And I was like, obviously you're not listening. And she said, no, do you think you're going to drink today? And I was like, no. And she said, why? And I said, well, I just came from an 8-hour meeting, because that was my home group over there. It was like 8 hours. I said, I just came from an 8-hour meeting. I said, I'm sponsoring 5 people. I've gone through the book. I've, you know, done my steps. I have a relationship with God. I've said my prayers. I called 3 newcomers. I did this. I did this. I did this. I listed off all the things I did that day to keep myself sober. And she looked at me. She said, you're awfully powerful for someone who's supposed to be powerless. And that was the first time something had hit me in my gut in like 8 months, when all the things outside of me had started. That was the first thing that got through. And that's when I knew I had a major problem with step 1, because at some point, My ego had rebuilt itself where I was believing that I was keeping myself sober. I had made myself believe that I choose not to drink today. And I'm here to tell you that at least this alcoholic does not make any choice about it at all. I choose that God is everything. That is the only choice I have. I choose to turn my will and my life over. Steps 4 through 9 show me how to do that. 3 is a decision. 4 through 9 is the action of turning it. Some people are like, turn it over. I'm like, how do you do that? Turn it, just do this. How? That was, I was the how girl in all of New Jersey. I don't get it, you know? And finally, I was like, okay, 4 through 9. I get it. That happened. That makes 3 happen. Okay. So I get to 10, and I start practicing it. And I'm sitting at my desk sometimes, you know, I'll even be sitting in court sometimes, and I sit there and I write out inventory. Because I am ready to strangle somebody, and I know it has nothing to do with what goes on outside of me today. I know that my disease is nothing but inside my head. My head is not a good place to be unsupervised. And that is the necessary need for this program, because the only thing that keeps me sober today, the only thing that keeps me sane today is God. And the only way to God, as far as I know, are through the 12 steps of this program and through the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where I need you guys to interpret it for me so I can get there. And it all starts with being honest. So thanks for letting me share.